Okay, thank you for drinking your cup of tea so fast and getting back. That's good. What we wanted to do today is to acknowledge the fact that one of the issues in marriage difficulties relates to the whole issue of sexuality and sexual intimacy. We want to not avoid this issue, as it's sometimes just addressed in a very general way. On the other hand, we don't want to give the idea that we believe that all marriage problems are sexual problems. And we're going to make a fairly clear definition as we go along this morning. And one is that some sexual difficulties in marriage are symptoms of something else. And sometimes sexual difficulties are, in fact, the primary problem. So we'll try and define as we go along at different times whether we're talking about sexual difficulties as a primary cause of marital tension, or whether we're talking about it as a secondary effect of something else that's going on. And we're going to sort of kick off by just dialoguing a little bit about what we've discovered in marriage about maleness and femaleness that you don't always see in the books, and lay a bit of a basis for some of the early pain that people experience in early marriage. So we'll try to do that. What we want to do is invite you to dialogue with us. So rather than do what we did in the last session and save the questions to the end, we want you to feel free, as the question pops into your mind, to indicate that somehow. And we'll run with it. If you have a question that you'd like to ask but you would rather it didn't go on the tape with your voice on it, we can do that, all right. You just let us know that and we'll switch the tape off, and then I can rephrase the question for you on tape and you can ask it in anonymity. But you may not worry about that. But if you do, just let us know. One of the things that I did not understand when we got married, just coming to think of it, I wondered what I did understand when we got married. Just a thought that struck me. We were very fortunate as a couple because we did get some marriage counselling, pre-marriage counselling, on the Friday night before we were married. As we were walking out the door after signing the forms, the minister put his arms around us and said, "Whatever you do to do, don't lose your sense of humour." And you know, that was excellent advice. We remembered it about 24 hours later. And if we hadn't laughed, we'd have cried. And it's been good advice in the last 28 years as well. But that was all we did have. And one of the things that I didn't understand was the difference between male sexual turn-on or stimulation and female sexual turn-on or stimulation. Mm. I thought it was the same. I thought that because when I saw you streak from the bathroom to the bedroom, that did something to me. I thought when you saw me do that, it would do something to you. And I soon discovered that for some reason better known unto the Creator himself, he didn't make women necessarily like that.
No. Let me say first that I think my turn on was fairly visual. During our courting years too,
that as I can understand that.
That as we were developing our relationship, I guess stimulation came from holding hands, touching one another, and showing affection to one another, and that to me is being stimulated. And I guess as we were married, things were different. that I wasn't stimulated in the same manner.
So female sexual turn on, if it's not by what you see,
it's by
what is it?
By what I'm feeling at the time. So that if I feel that I'm being loved and appreciated, then that is a sexual stimulation to me. That is, I want to express my love. I suppose, yeah, to me, love has to be consistent. So that when I get up of a morning, to feel, I guess the way you say good morning is important to me. The way you go off to work in the morning has always been something that has been important to me. It all says something, so that if you go off in the morning without saying goodbye, well, I sort of feel, hey, where's he gone? Mm. He didn't say goodbye. And I guess a part of that comes from the type of family I was brought up in.
Yeah.
You see, kissing my mother goodbye was important.
Yeah, you came from a very kissy family, didn't
you? Yeah, I did. An affectionate family. We did express affection to one another.
It used to terrify me, your family. You know, the thing that frightened me most about our wedding day was the thought that I was going to stand at the door of the hall and these 120 people are going to go past and slobber all over me.
How come you've changed?
Oh, well, you've got to get with it, I say. But,
That is important. And, the little things that you did to help was important. It was... I needed the security of a consistent love. And the fact that you were sensitive, the fact that you helped when I called... at times I called peak hour times, was an expression of love and consideration.
So,
and for me to feel sexual, that was very much a part of it, because if I felt that all you wanted was intercourse, if that was the only expression of love that and sensitivity and caring that I experienced, well, to me it just wasn't a turn on.
So what you're saying is that as long as you felt valued and warm and encouraged and accepted and approved, then that did something to your sexuality.
Mm.
And the reverse of that is if you were not feeling those things, that made you feel less likely to, less sexually stimulated.
Mm.
Whereas with me, as a young person, we could have an argument at 10 o'clock and you could do your streaking act at 5 past and I could forget the argument by 5 and a half past. and that created for me tremendous tension, because, and I'm sure it did for you too, because you see, if I didn't understand that, if I didn't understand that your sexual turn on wasn't the same as mine, how was I to interpret the times when you were very definite about no sex tonight, you know? And to do it not just no sex tonight, dear, but no sex tonight, dear, see?
Mm.
How was I to interpret that? How was I to understand that?
Mm.
And the only thing that I was left with was to interpret it that you didn't like sex.
Mm.
Now, I knew that wasn't true, but what do you do with that? And you know all these stories about fellas turning over and thumping their pillow. Mm. I mean, my pillow had internal injuries for most of its life, because I really didn't understand that. I didn't appreciate that. And I reckon that is one of the things that lies at the root of sexual difficulties often, is the ignorance about the difference between male and female.
Because And I don't think that I don't think it's necessarily a female characteristic, although it appears to be more strongly female.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. That our sexual turn-on is feeling secure in our loving.
Yeah.
And love needs to be consistent.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the difficulties we had was, okay, when I was angry with you, there's no way where I could turn out to be the perfect lover of Noah just by seeing you streak from the bathroom to the... In fact, that'd be a put-off. But because I'm feeling angry. And therefore, that I was saying, really, we need to talk, but I withdrew.
Yeah.
And in my withdrawing, that was the only way I could say to you, hey, I'm hurting, we need to talk, and yet I couldn't talk.
Mm. Well, one of the other areas that raises, of course, is that as I began to realise that, I realised, you know, if Julie's feeling really good, then obviously she is going to feel more open to me sexually. Then I started to get angry about that because you know what I interpreted that as? You be a good boy and it'll pay off. And I thought, oh, that's not right, you know, that's not what a relationship should be built on. But I realised, of course, it wasn't that. It was an autonomic reaction, an automatic reaction. The other thing is that we have met husbands and wives who actually operate in reverse. Women who are very much visually stimulated and men who are more affected by their feelings. But that's not very often.
No.
Until you get to middle age. I reckon as you get older, males become more female. That now I can be much more easily put off. I mean, when I was 25, you'd have needed a double regiment to put me off, you know. But now I can be easily put off by things you say, or
because you're affected more by feelings.
By feelings, and I think that's because as you get older, you change.
It's interesting to understand, isn't it, that the various stages of marriage, like when we had four little children and we had four young ones fairly closely, it was important for you to understand that maybe tiredness was one of those things that caused me not to desire to make love, because by 10 o'clock at night or whatever, it almost sometimes became like another chore.
Yeah.
Oh, I've got to perform here, when really I've been worn out. Now, recognising that can be an issue or a problem, therefore, for my sake and for your sake, for our sake, I need to look at that and say, well, what can I do so that my husband's not just getting the worn-out wife of the night, that I have a responsibility to organise my time and my family so that we can have quality time together and fun time together.
Yeah, I used to appreciate that.
Let's put a couple of things up here on the board, hon, as we go along. So the first one we've talked about is that some sexual difficulties can be related to ignorance. And I just simply want to get on one of my old bandwagons and say that I think in the church we should be educating people about sexuality a great deal more than we are. Church is silent about sexuality, and I believe that interwoven into our whole teaching and discipling program, there needs to be a sexual education program, so that it doesn't become something on its own, but it's part of our entire teaching.
It's very interesting that some of the early sex education in schools was actually from the churches.
And how
that commitment was lost and has been taken over largely by other groups.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, we've been really burdened about this, and we've just written a booklet which will come out in a couple of months, I think, that has a look at the issues that have to be addressed at all the different age levels, and then ways in which this can be done as part of a church program. So hopefully that might be helpful.
I think another area of ignorance that we perhaps haven't talked about is what sort of input we've had in our childhood.
Mm.
The lack of sexual education, the fear of not even raising it with our parents. So we can go into our own marriage with no education whatsoever.
Oh yes, and the models that are, that we live with, you know, parents who we never see show affection. You know, lots of young couples who've come to our engaged couples weekend have said, you know, that the thought that their mothers and fathers might still do it, it never occurred to them. You see, and when they see us talking, you know, us oldies sitting up front talking, they say, and we run marriage enrichments, engaged couples weekends at the same time, two different groups, but in the same place at the same time, and they meet for meals. And this fascinating story: this young couple had been married for 6 months, 4 months, I think, and a couple who had been married 40 years. And after dinner one night, I was walking through the dining room. There they were, these two couples. Of all the other couples had gone, these two couples were sitting there, and the older couple were talking in very excited ways, and this couple, their eyes were just sticking out here. And I said to Julia, I wonder what on earth they're saying to them, you see. And afterwards we said to this couple, what were you saying to those kids? And they said, we were telling them about how much we enjoy our sexual life. And they were over 60, 65 or something, and this couple couldn't believe it. And this young couple said to this older couple, you know, we thought that you only enjoyed your sexual life until you were 30. That's what they told them. So they were really relieved. They went home really excited.
It was interesting, love, in regards to our upbringing, how I had an opportunity of sharing with a lady at one time where all her mother had said to her before her wedding day was, look, he'll only want one thing.
Mm.
And that was her sex education from her family, was all he'll want is one thing. And obviously the mother was speaking out of her own anger and hurt,
yes,
and her own experiences, mm, and putting that on her daughter who was going into marriage.
The third thing that affects, that lies at the basis of some sexual difficulties is trauma. I came into marriage as a child abuse victim. And for me personally, although we were Christians and I was very determined not to project that on you very often, for me personally that was a very great difficulty that I had to face. But perhaps for girls even more so, who've been abused by their father. I don't know whether you understand with child abuse, one of the issues that's important is the difference in age between the victim and the perpetrator, and the closeness of the relationship determines the intensity of the trauma. So father or grandfather and little daughter or granddaughter will be much more traumatic in its long-term effect than 13-year-old next-door neighbour's son and little girl, for some reason or other. And so that girls who have been sexually abused by their fathers or by their grandfathers often bring into their marriage tremendous trauma, tremendous fear. Some of the things that a child abuse person feels, for instance, and I'm sure those of you who've been through the experience will relate to this, is you cannot go into a room of people without feeling you're different from everybody else. Mm. It's an overriding feeling that I am different. Even though you know that one in five people might have suffered with child abuse, it makes no difference. You just believe you're the only one. And when that sort of person moves into marriage, that what you begin to feel is, my partner cannot possibly understand how I feel. So you imagine from a woman's point of view how difficult it is when in lovemaking she's got that belief, you know. He cannot know how I feel. And the other thing is, of course, that the father was the most significant male in her life and he hurt her, and now the husband is the most significant male in her life, so he will hurt me too. And so there's when it's not healed, where there's not a lot of recovery taken place, this is a very painful issue.
And having to live with the secrecy of the whole thing.
Mm.
It's interesting that a sexual abused child often feels more angry with the mother than the perpetrator.
Yes, that's right. Mm. Because we have this belief that mother should protect us.
Mm.
And somehow mother failed.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. That's right. So there's that sort of trauma. There's other traumas too, like unfortunate sexual experiences in teen years maybe, or a pregnancy in an early as a teenager, or an abortion as a teenager. A lot of these sorts of things can create guilts and fears and anxieties and self-condemnatory type attitudes that are then projected into the relationship and makes intercourse a uncomfortable and unacceptable thing. Traumas like broken family. I just wonder what the impact of so many, 80% of our children in primary schools today growing up in either a one-parent family or a family where one adult is other than their real parent, and wondering what sort of effect that's going to have on our children's sexuality. Well, there's a big argument, isn't there? A big issue here that some people believe it has a big bearing on our homosexual problem, that while we're born male and female, that the sexual orientation and the health of our orientation is fashioned by the environment and the impact that comes into our childhood from parents and those who surround us at the time, and that the theory is that it's possible by the time a little boy is six to have been so crushed and hurt by the weak or absent father and the strong dominating mother or a number of other combinations that his orientation is already set at a homosexual level rather than a heterosexual level. Now, let me just say that's a theory, but in practice, what I've found is that I counsel lots and lots of people who are homosexual in orientation but not in practice, and many of them very strongly committed to fidelity, and many strongly committed to living what they see to be a moral life, and are outside of any sort of homosexual practice, but day by day live their lives out with this pain of knowing that they are homosexual in orientation, so that the girl who feels like this has to go into the girls' dressing room on a sports day at school. She has to shower with the other girls and undress with the other girls. And it'd be the same as putting a normal heterosexual or a heterosexual person into the dressing room of the opposite sex. And she lives with that awful pain. Now, who does she tell? She's the finest Christian girl in your church. She's the leader of the youth group. She stands up and plays a musical instrument and so on. Who does she tell that she is in fact homosexual? I mean, I can imagine that she could be able to stand up in church and say, or anybody could stand up in church and say, brothers and sisters, I'm a dried out alcoholic, but I often fight with the temptation to drink. Will you pray with me? And we'd almost make a hero out of that person. But if somebody stood up and said, ever since I was six, I've had a homosexual orientation, and I struggle with the pain of being attracted to people of my own sex, will you pray with me? I wonder how churches could cope with that. Now, the reason I'm making a bit of a point with it here, and I want to mention it later, is that there are lots of people with that sort of orientation who, because we live in a marriage-orientated society, are almost forced into marriage. And then when they get married, they have this either total rejection of heterosexuality or a very low sexual drive. There's a diagram that some of you will want to argue with, and that's fine. I don't mind you arguing with it because it can be argued with. But if you drew a curve like that and you put homosexual at one end here and heterosexual at the other and divided it in the middle, the argument is that we all have an orientation, a sexual orientation, and that most people fall somewhere along this line. An increasing number of people who fall along this line. Now, I'm not talking about choice in behaviour here. I'm talking about orientation, okay? So I'm quite sure that heterosexuals can choose to be involved in homosexual acts. And I'm quite sure the Bible says that's sinful. And I'm quite sure the scripture is prohibitionist about that. So I want you to know that before you stone me to death, because I like to die with some credibility. But I'm talking about orientation, and the people who fall up this end of the line are probably your criminal heterosexuals who rape people and do all sorts of horrible criminal type things. And down here near the middle, you've got a small group of people who are heterosexual, but their sexual drive is almost negligible. And that's a very painful thing if they marry somebody with a strong sexual drive, be they male or female, and we've found that works both ways. Sometimes men have very low sexual drives and they marry women who have a much higher expectation, and that's very difficult for that couple. And a lot of pain and anger can be generated there, and vice versa. In here you'd probably find the persons who have fairly normal, what we tend to call normal, because there's more people with it. So we come to normal, isn't it? Most people fall there. If we all walked around with pigs' heads under our arms like they do in New Guinea, we'd say that's normal, okay? So these people were the people who can relate fairly well heterosexually. And on this side of the line, down here, you've probably got the homosexual orientation, people who've never been involved at all in homosexual acts. And up here you've probably got your more criminal ones. But in here you've got an interesting group of people, some who are in homosexual relationships, but other Christians with quite strong homosexual drives who've chosen never to live homosexually, who live with that pain. And I have pastor friends, single pastor friends, and one or two married pastor friends who live there and who have a fantastic ministry, but live with that awful loneliness that nobody else, probably hardly anybody else, will ever know there. And I want to just encourage you in your churches, whenever you talk about sexuality, I hope you do. Our experience is when we go to a church and do it, speak about it, people say, this is the first time. So I hope you do. But when you do, make sure that one of the things you say is that you talk about orientation. Don't leave that out, because it's a very important issue.
I was thinking one of the pressures that we tend to put on people who are, say, in their late 20s, early 30s, just in a joking manner, we sort of talk about them being on the shelf or, you know, because we come from a marriage-oriented society, we tend to want to say, well, you know, you're a bit slow or... and put that pressure on them. Now, I'm not saying that means that they're homosexual orientated, but I think we do have to be careful what pressures we put on young people if they're not courting or they don't appear to want to be married at this point of time. We do put pressures on them.
We must make sure that they know singleness is an acceptable state. If they choose to remain single, it's important for them to know that that's okay. And then there's physiological issues. There are some people who wrestle with very real problems that can be righted with proper counselling and sometimes proper teaching and often proper medical treatment. Let's talk about some of those. One would be the man who finds it difficult to maintain an erection, or another form of that would be premature ejaculation. Lots of men that you will counsel suffer with that, but the interesting thing is that in most cases it can be corrected. Although it would be one of the most distressing of the physiological problems, it's one of the easiest to correct. Sometimes they can be taught how to correct it themselves, and sometimes they may need longer counsel. But as a little resource that you can write down, there's an excellent book that you all should have called Intended for Pleasure. And there is an excellent chapter on the three major sexual problems that people face, and premature ejaculation is one of them, and there's a very excellent self-help program for that particular problem. And if a person finds it difficult, a couple finds it difficult to engage in that program, then they may need some more counsel, but it's worth doing. By the way, there are lots of very good books on sexuality. That's one of them. There's a secular book called The Joy of Sex, which I also think as Christians we ought to have. But when you have them, when you get them, if you haven't got them now, make sure you put them in the bookshelf in your lounge room. Not in your office where nobody goes. In the lounge room, or if necessary, in the hallway where they have to pass. Because, you see, and don't put a brown paper cover on them.
What about the kids?
Oh, the kids love them. every time you go out, have a look at the pictures. I wouldn't worry about it too much. I wished I'd seen a few pictures like that when I was a kid, except the ones on the toilet doors. But leave it there, because it's amazing how many people will walk past, look at it, and look at you, and look at it, and then one day they'll say to you, "Do you think I could borrow that book? Would you mind putting a brown paper cover on it?" But one of the things, it makes a statement about you as a person. It says, we as a couple, or I as a person, this person, isn't afraid to see this as one of the important issues in our lives. And we need to be saying that very strongly all the time. And so if you've got people coming into your home, keep those books well and truly in the open. But, Ed Wheat, Wheat. And he and his wife wrote, by the way, some of you are active marriage people, by Tim LaHaye. It's interesting that Ed Wheat wrote the medical section of Tim LaHaye's book. So that's exactly the same, except it's a bit updated. He's also got two tapes, I think, two cassettes called Techniques and Problems and Techniques, Sexual Problems and Techniques. Do you have them here?
Right.
I was going to say, Andrew and Jan have a copy. Okay, and the folks, you're good. Okay, so they are available. Who's we? Would you like to tell
Outreach
us?
Book Service.
Outreach Book Service has got them. Graham will be able to fix you up for that too. The other thing is that they've written another book called Love Life for Every Married Couple, which is a must to give to couples before they're married. Read it if you haven't read it, but before couples are married, give them that lovely little book, or when they get married, give it to them. It looks at all the aspects of marriage, not just the sexual area, and it's a fascinating book. It's one of the most practical books I've seen, obviously written by an honest married couple. Yeah.
Well.
Oh, is there really? Oh, good. Do you have those two, Graham?
What was the name of that one?
Love Life for Every Married Couple.
No.
Oh, right. Graham's getting them, so that'll be fine. Hey.
I was just thinking perhaps one of the struggles perhaps for the female, so often when we're caught up in the romance of going together, the preparation of a wedding and being caught up in the airy-fairiness of that,
yeah,
we often haven't stopped to think about what happens after that that night.
Mm.
And often for the woman, it can be just such a hurtful, tragic experience because of lack of education, pre-education, and no understanding of it all, of myself as a female, what I think about myself, what I feel about myself, how I've related to the opposite sex in the past, and then all of a sudden I'm thrown in the bed with someone that I love, but often feel very hurt because of...
So there's no knowledge of foreplay and the importance of understanding that a woman takes longer to reach a point of higher sexual desire than the man, and the the whole business of
very much inhibited because of past experiences, or
yeah,
because
that's right.
I haven't learned to accept who I am as a female, and that thoughts and feelings are natural.
Yeah. So what sort of physiological problems does that lead to? I guess it would lead to pain, physical pain, mm-hmm. because of the lack of lubrication, because two people in too much of a hurry, or because they don't understand the importance of taking time and the importance of foreplay and things like that.
Yeah. And I think my attitude towards it, maybe if my attitude towards sex has been that of, we don't talk about it, it's dirty, I shouldn't enjoy it.
Mm.
Those sort of things are all right. contributing factors to hurt and pain.
The other one that you often talk to folks about, honey, is the business of women not being able to achieve an orgasm. Mm-hmm. And that becomes quite a physiological issue, doesn't it? Quite as well as an emotional issue.
Yeah. Sometimes I think the attitude has been sex is for him, he gets more enjoyment out of it. I have to put up with it. And therefore, I don't get the opportunity to initiate and to enjoy foreplay. He's insensitive to where I'm at during lovemaking. In fact, sometimes it would be easy to see it as a selfish need being met.
He reaches
climax
before I do, to give me time. Mm. Yeah, all those sorts of things. Plus the fact that in our society today there is an overemphasis on the big O as being the most important thing. So people, if they're not reaching orgasm regularly, become very unhappy and distressed about that, and either blame themselves or blame their husbands. And it's really important to take the emphasis off that area when you're working with people and help them understand that it's only an aspect of lovemaking. There's other beautiful things like the pleasure you give each other in foreplay, and the closeness between two people. There's lots of other things that are very important to
and
be thinking about.
And recognising too that our needs may differ. Like you said before, my sexual need might be greater than yours, and therefore we need to be able to talk about that and come to some way of celebrating that's not putting pressure on one and hurting one, but meeting the needs of the other also.
And another common problem that we come across is frigidity. And I always advise counsellors like yourselves to make sure that you have in your little black book the appropriate names or names of appropriate therapists, doctors or sexual therapists, who you can refer people to. I want to make an... yes, Graham.
Hormonal situation come into this, and the difference, some of it does happen at different stages.
Sure. That's my mistake. The different hormonal levels are seen pretty much in that diagram I showed you before, where in terms of different drives, different levels of drive and different levels of need. And it's important to check that out rather than just accept that that's me. It's important, I should have said this before, it's important that we check out hormonal levels. Now, I had a very interesting experience the other day. I sent a lady to a doctor, her own doctor, because I wanted that to be checked out for her. And the doctor said, there isn't anything, there's no way of doing that, you see. But I know there are clinics, and you might be able to help us here, Ken, but I know there are clinics in Melbourne who do that sort of work in some of the big hospitals, and where men in particular have had very great help with hormonal treatment. But I don't understand it from a medical point of view. I only know that people I've sent to the clinic have come away pretty excited about that. Are you aware of any of that area?
Just within capital cities, usually. I mean, quite often, if GPs don't know, then the specialists within the area would know, like for instance, gynecologists for females, or I guess urologists for males.
Mm.
So that they're often which points to call.
And I like to suggest, if you do a lot of counselling, check out those sorts of lines and talk to the people yourself so that they know that who you are, and when you do ring them for either referral or advice, they know who you are and they can immediately respond to that and build up a bit of a relationship with them if you can. And one of the very great strengths of Elkanah down in Melbourne is that we have a huge list of people who right across Australia, actually, although we're pretty light on in Sydney, we just don't seem to have had all the right contacts up here. But in a lot of the other cities, people who specialise in various other fields. But I'm sure you could find that all out here.
But even Patagonians don't seem to always know.
No.
I mean, they'll prescribe medication for certain things, and you'll say there's a problem in this area, the sex drive is cut out.
Mm.
In actual fact, you can get to the stage where the sex is, it's a hurtful thing, you don't want it, it's really. And you know, they say, no, it's not right, it wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
But quite obviously, it does.
It does do that, yeah. The same with certain other drugs and certain other treatments for various other illnesses can lower the libido quite strongly, and some doctors don't seem to understand that, and they don't read their MIMS books very well.
I was going to suggest in this area, the Sydney
Adventist
Hospital has
good
education program.
Which hospital
is
that?
Sydney Adventist Hospital.
Sydney
Adventist. Run by the Adventist
good.
Church.
Yes.
Has a lot of good educational programs covering all aspects of health.
Right.
And if, you know, somebody wanted to find someone to ring up the counsellors there, or even the chaplain's department, they really
work. Yeah. That's terrific. Yeah, don't tend to mess around if somebody comes and says, our sexual life's a mess. Hear them out, but look for the people who are going to be most suited to treat them. And I have a little theory here. If the best person in the city is a Christian, that's fine. But if the best person for that particular problem is not a Christian, that's fine too. I would rather use in specialist areas a good non-Christian than an untrained or unskilled Christian. Now, I don't know what you think of that, but in those specialist areas I would feel very strongly about that.
I was just going to say that one of the problems with the medical profession here is that it really is only perhaps in the last decade where the whole area of the interface between sexuality and disease or age or medications has really been addressed. So the problem arises that, in general, my generation of the profession and onwards really have never been specifically trained in this area unless we take out the time to look for it. And so this is a major problem where you have to look for the people specifically, you know, to find out who do know. And clearly in this area, I think that if there is a physical medical problem that is the cause, it is absolutely tragic that you miss it, because frequently it is in fact the most treatable. You know, if someone has one of these rather unusual problems, so at least it's very good to know that that's not a problem in some way or another.
And somehow we've got to get across to our church people too, there is no shame in seeking help for sexual difficulties. And we say to the kids at the relationship enrichment weekend, you know, one of the things you want to lock in your mind now and talk about and contract on is if we do run into some sort of a difficulty down the way, the first thing we're going to do is go for help, you know. Make a contract now, because if you don't, the chances are, if it's a guy's problem, he's going to get upset and say, no, I won't go for help. So make the contract now before you know whose problem it's going to be. And we often ask couples when we marry them, come back and see us in 6 weeks' time and bring your photographs and things, and then during that conversation, because we've been really open with them, they'll always start to talk to us about how things are going. And even then, we've occasionally picked up issues that were worth talking through, even in 6 weeks after they're married. So try to get that across to people.
I was just going to say there, I think with all sexual difficulties, It can't be treated as my problem or his problem.
It's our problem.
Treated as our problem.
Yes.
Because together we're going to seek help and together we're going to work it through. Because I think there are times when maybe for some of us we go through our married life and our sexual relationship has been beautiful and nothing wrong and have enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But maybe we come to a stage in our life where we start to change and struggle, maybe change of life, and then all of a sudden we find ourselves in difficulty. Hey, we've...
Please turn the tape over at this point.
True. Because I think there are times when maybe for some of us we go through our married life and our sexual relationship has been beautiful and nothing wrong and have enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But maybe we come to a stage in our life where we start to change and struggle, maybe change of life, and then all of a sudden we find ourselves in difficulty. Hey, we've never had to cope with this before, and I know Graham and I are going through this at the present time. My desire has dropped. Maybe I have no need for it at this point of time, and what's going on here? And if we're not understanding one another, or if we're not talking about it, then it becomes a very painful situation.
Yeah, which raises, we'll come back to you, Graham, in a minute, but it raises the issue of life stages. You know, the life stage when you've got little children is a difficult time, because you're just tired and weary and just don't have time. But the midlife crisis stage, what Julie's alluding to, that's where we're at right now, the big 5-0, and both having our own little sorties through midlife, it really for us is a
we're facing
interesting
that we've
time
we've never had to face before. And it would be easy to sit back and say, oh, well, it's my fault, or but it is our situation. We need to work through it and understand one another and love one another. And
it's like Julie was never, PMT lady, ever. You know, I was never a calendar watcher, fellas. I was really a lucky bloke and never had to worry because she'd never get depressed prior to or after or during or any time. And then all of a sudden, it started to happen, you know. And I could not believe it, you know, that she would get real dark, deep depressions and really angry. And I thought,
yeah,
what on earth is happening? And she couldn't believe it either because it was really very scary, wasn't it? But one of the things I realised that we're doing, I just recognised it recently, is because there isn't as much sexual intimacy as such, we've put in its place a lot of other things, like a lot of touching, a lot of holding, a lot of wrestling, a lot of fun, you know, games, things that have taken its place and have kept the lightheartedness there, you know.
Because otherwise you could take it personally and say, hey, she doesn't love me anymore, she doesn't want me, she doesn't need me. And that can be painful, but if we're loving in every other area, and then if we can't enjoy intercourse at this point of time, as long as we're secure in our love for one another.
And it's important to me to know that she's not hoping it'll go on forever. Graham.
I was just going to say, in the light of what you said about being thin on the ground with reference points, reference people, that we could get Dr. Cedric and Dr. Graham here, who are also authorised celibates, with our authorised celibate situation, to frame up a list of specialists for you over a period of time. We'll let you have them, and then we'll make them available to our authorised celibates in this state.
That'd be fantastic.
Because we often have people ringing our partner saying, who can I go to see in Sydney?
From all over Australia.
Well, there's not only who can we go to, we're pretty thin on the ground in the counselling area as well, which this group here is very encouraging, that maybe a core group here that we can look to in respect to counselling situations in the future.
Yes, well, just one thing on the counselling aspect, quickly, there's a lot of non-Christian counsellors who, in a lot of circumstances, they've been actively encouraged couples to separate instead of, you know, being positive in some areas.
Well, you have two streams, you see. You've got your reconciliatory counsellors and your separation counsellors. And you've got to know who's who.
I think onto the life stages too, maybe we could add, hysterectomy can change.
Yes, that's right. Hysterectomy can change life in various ways, but one of those is it often brings the whole menopausal thing on a lot earlier. And suddenly people in their 30s find that they're struggling with their midlife changes, which are very difficult for them. Treatment for things like multiple sclerosis and some of those illnesses can have those effects. And epilepsy too, I think. Yeah. Sugar diabetes, yes. Good to understand that. Effect of alcohol is another one that probably you might need to keep in mind for counselling, that the old romantic idea that if you drink it makes you more virile isn't correct. Okay. Anybody else got comments or questions? Let's hear from you for a minute. Any thoughts, suggestions, questions?
I'm just thinking in terms of ignorance and upbringing and those things. And I'm seeing a generation, my generation and another generation, much more open in the present generation. So I'm wondering if it is really still the same with that younger generation, or are we presuming our generation's marital counselling and thoughts about sex and their freedom about sex? I guess I'm asking, are they not more free about it today?
I think our experience is no, they're not, generally speaking. When we are dealing with young couples in pre-marriage situations, we find that they know all the technical things and they've been subjected to all the romantic things, but there's a great big gap in between in terms of the link between emotions and sexuality, the link between past hurts and sexuality, the link between past input and sexuality, that those things we're still basically very ignorant about, and they're really the issues. And I think about, we came from a time where we were basically ignorant, had no input, but when it came to technique, it didn't take us long, see. When it came to understanding the biological things that we didn't understand before marriage, that didn't take long either. But the big gap in the middle, where some people never make up ground, is these, I think Graham called interfaces, these connections between the biological and the psychological and the environmental and the emotional, and those sorts of things. And I think that's where we're still falling down, because in our education programs at school, we're not covering those, and a lot of our pre-marriage counselling is not covering that, and a lot of our books don't cover that. So I think that's still a very big area that we need to work on.
I think we tend to presume that because of what we see on our television screens and young people today at school and the amount of fornication that's going on and so forth, people choosing to live together, we presume that kids know it all. But when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of loving, they know very little about loving, and that's often where once a couple who have perhaps been living together and have had what seems to be a reasonable happy sex life together, they decide that they should be married, and then often it falls apart after they're married, because they just don't really understand what loving is and how a woman ticks and how a man ticks.
So that interface between love and sex is a very important one that we still need to be working on.
I was going to mention too a good book for young children, which I found terrific, is Who Made Me, a Christian book.
Yes.
And I get concerned, as far as the church goes, that they should have a bit more openness in the right setting, because children go to school and they might hear the wrong emphasis about it from people outside the church, and I think a lot of young families would need encouragement as, you know, things get more open and time goes on, just in relation to their children when they ask questions.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
So that's an excellent book for you.
It is a challenge to us as parents with young children, because often if we haven't come to grips with our own sexuality and feel comfortable about that, then we're not always able to give the sound teaching that we need to our own children. And often we think our attitude is they're too little, they're too young to understand. But I believe if a child is old enough to ask a question, then we should give that child an adequate answer.
Yes.
I'm very precious with the idea that they're too little, and one day it's too late. And there's nothing in between. I was very interested talking to my mother. She's a school teacher and she's just in charge of girls. And she's this wonderful lot chelp in the lounge room of the joy of sex and various educational books at different ages, because she just had to evaluate these things and just make decisions for the school. And my sister and I had read the entire shelf by the time she caught me one day, and I didn't realise it privately, but when she went out, we used to read them. So I think you're a bit young for that one, you know. I put it back, and I didn't tell her it was my last one with the shelf on. And she made a big effort, and she always describes herself as being very open with us, unlike her parents that were very inhibited. Mm. And then when my first child was born, my grandmother, her mother, lived with us, and she always said that, you know, even though her mother had never told her anything, she was always very open with my mother. And I couldn't believe this is hearing the two sides. And my mother's got to be very open with me, and she has got to be joking. How could she possibly think that? You know, if it wasn't for the book from the show, yeah. Basically talking about those technical things. They weren't talking about the relationship building, but they were talking about the anatomy and the physiology. And it was very useful, not having any brothers or anything like that. And I wonder whether what we consider to be open in our marriages and our communication, and I wonder about what we feel we're doing the best with our children to be open and progressive. I wonder what they'll think about how open we are. And I think maybe our standards, it's so hard for us to discuss that, is that we really shortchange our children by, you know, the question is, would we let them see those sort of books, which tells us where our community attitudes are? It's still a no-no.
And if you work only at the answer the question level, and I know Julie wasn't saying that's the only level, but if you do, you're open with some of your kids and not open with the others. And I know that we were talking about this one day, our kids all grown up, and we think we were open with them. They don't all think we were, so that's interesting. But we commented on masturbation. You see, one of the boys said, oh, Dad talked to me about that, and that was a really big help. The other one said, never talk to me. You see, now the basis of my talking to him was he came with the problem and he said, Dad, you know, I'm really worried about this. Will you talk to me about it? The other one had the problem but didn't talk about it. And I think that what we've... So that's why we end up with that sort of feeling that we're open because we're ready to answer questions, but the kids don't always ask the questions. And one does and the rest don't. And so I wish now that I had sat down deliberately, not because I was asked a question, but at 12 years of age and so on, and began to explore these areas. The way I explored it with my son, by the way, and this might be worth sharing with you, is just sharing my own journey. And you know, if you really want to be open with your kids, share your own journey through sexuality. Don't be afraid. Tell them where you were at. Tell them what you felt. Tell them what you did. Tell them the struggles, the guilt that you carried, and share it with them. Help them understand how you got to the answer, or how you're getting to the answer. But don't come over as the experts. Don't come over as, this is the way, you know, you should think. The kids look at you and say, I wonder if he did, you know. But be honest. Share your journey. Be real. Be authentic. And the kids will thank you for it. What we need to do before we finish, is to, how do we address these sorts of problems? Somebody comes to us and says, my husband and I, my wife and I, have these horrific sexual difficulties. How do we cope with them? Let's give you four things that we think are helpful in this area. Number one, listen without trying to provide a solution. Step one, listen without attempting to provide a solution. if you listen with the thought in your mind that you have got to come up with a solution, like why don't you buy a good book, or why don't you go and see a therapist or whatever, if you do that, it means you're not going to listen deeply enough to be therapeutic, right? The only way you can listen deeply enough to be therapeutic is by putting out of your mind any obligation to come up with an answer. Now, I've been counselling for a while now, and I do that very deliberately still. When somebody sits down, the thought in my mind is, hear and explore. Right? Not hear and respond. Do you get that? If that's the only thing you remember out of the day, it'll be important. Hear or listen and explore. That is, my first reaction after I've heard will be to help this person explore so that I understand the problem better and they understand it better. Hear and explore, not hear and respond. If you're locked into, and I might tell you 99.5% of Christians are locked into hear and respond, then you're only going to half hear and your response is likely to be off kilter because it's too quick and you don't know the problem. So when somebody comes and they sit down with you and they begin to share, hear and explore and listen therapeutically. Some sexual problems can be overcome simply by the experience of being deeply listened to. I mean, two people are listened to, they can often go away and say, you know, it feels good that we're not being judged or criticized for that. But somebody's really heard us and said, yes, that is a deep, painful problem. You know, it's amazing the impact, and I've noticed this, and you've probably noticed this. When somebody shares something with you, you just put your hand on their arm or their shoulder and say, or maybe not, but you simply say, boy, that must be painful. The impact of those few words are more powerful than you'll ever know. A person goes away and says, somebody knows. Somebody even is attempting to understand how painful it really is. So the first step, the first stage, is to listen deeply, very, very deeply. The second stage is to don't be afraid to share your own experience. Don't be afraid to share your own experience. And this is part of the explore thing, that as you explore, identify at the points where it's appropriate to identify without taking the focus off their problem. And ways in which that might be done is if you're working as a couple, or you're working as, when Julie and I are sometimes working as a couple, is to say, for me just to say, gee honey, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? You know? That sounds like where we were at a few years ago, or that's where we're at right now. And then immediately focus back onto that person's problem. Don't get onto yourself. But don't be afraid to identify. One of the things that we've found when we're speaking to people is, if I speak to young people about masturbation, and I say, you know, the figures are that 95% of teenage boys get into masturbation and the other 5% are liars. The kids immediately know that I've been there. I've travelled that journey too. And all the fellas, you know, young fellas will come up after the meeting and say, hey, thanks for that, you know. What about this? What about that? Full of questions. Because you've identified with their journey. Now, in the sexual area, more than any other area, if we've got the courage, we can identify with where people are at. Either because we were once there and we've come through it, or we are there now, and it's all right to do that. We did a marriage enrichment one time. It started off very badly for some reason or other. I can't remember why. But Julie was really struggling with one of her dark times in the menopause thing. And so when we got to dialogue about sexuality, we both ended up in tears. We were both talking about our struggles. And then when we looked up, everybody was in tears. And The group was basically a middle-aged group, and they were all just identifying so strongly. And they came to us afterwards and hugged us and said, you know, even if you'd said nothing else, it was worth coming to hear that another couple's travelling the same journey. So don't be afraid to identify, but don't identify in a way that takes the focus off them. Do you understand what I'm saying? You know what it is when people do that, don't you? You talk about your problem and they say, oh yes, I know all about that. I've been there and this is what happened to me and 25 years ago. This, and they go away and you think, strike, you know. Yeah, they weren't interested enough. So identify, but don't take the focus off yourself. That's the second step. The third step is identify, help them identify what the real problem is. Help them identify what the real problem is. Is it an ignorance problem? Is it a problem to do with the upbringing? Is it a trauma problem? Is it a physiological issue? As you explore, identify what the real problem is. Because some of them will think it's a spiritual problem, you see. And some will think it's a psychological problem and it's a physiological problem. And some will think it's a physiological problem and it's an emotional problem. So if you keep exploring, don't be in a hurry. They've been in the problem for a long time. They don't have to solve it tomorrow. Explore with them and see if eventually they reach a point of saying, that's what the problem is. We had a lovely story of a couple who were in their 60s who came to us and been married a long time. And they were staying at Elkana and sharing with me one day. And the guy said, you know, I suppose it's really too late in life to be talking about this. But he said, our sexual relationship has been a disaster since the day we were married. They had four or five kids and they were basically retired. He was retired. And I said, why? What's the problem? So they started to share it with me and told me what the problem was. And it was basically a premature ejaculation problem, and they'd never done a thing about it. And she had grown very angry and very resentful and very bitter, so there were other problems now as well. So we talked about it, and I just spent some time giving them a little bit of hope and so on. And I didn't know whether I should or I shouldn't be. One of those times you fly by the seat of your pants and really pray like mad and hope that you're doing the right thing. So I gave them some little techniques, you see. And I said, now what I want you to do this week is not to even attempt to make love, just do these things, go to bed and do these things, you see. So we set them up and they went ahead. About the third morning, they walked into my office and they were glowing like neon lights. You would not believe, I've never seen a couple of this age who were so obviously aglow. And I looked at them and I said, you didn't. And they said, we did. And for the first time in her life, first time in more than 40 years of marriage, she'd had an orgasm. And 60 or 65 or something. Which is amazing stuff. And anyway, they went home very happily after it was all over. And then one day we got this most marvellous letter from a woman we had never heard of before. And she said, I don't know what you did to Dad and Mum, but my husband are coming soon. My husband and I are coming soon. So, it was a delightful story. So, because we took some time to identify the real problem, they were able to work through it. So that's the third step. Don't assume it. Work through it. Counsellors make terrible mistakes when they make assumptions. You put A, B and C together and come up with D, and you're probably wrong. But do it, but then question it and be prepared to change as you go along. Of course you'll make some sorts of decisions as you go along, but be prepared to question them, but really identify the real problem. And then the fourth step is to ascertain your ability to deal with that problem. Now that's the hard one, isn't it? I reckon that you're safer as a counsellor, and I don't care how long you've been counselling, and I don't really care if you're the best counsellor in Sydney, you're safer if you work on the premise there's a fair chance that I'm going to have to refer this person. Because if you work on that premise, you're going to ask yourself some really honest questions. Now, I've been counselling for nearly 20 years full time, and I still quite regularly refer people. Not because I've not had that problem before, not because I haven't dealt with that problem before, but because there's something in my gut that says this person could be better dealt with by Dr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so or Mr. So-and-so. Sometimes I refer them because my gut says they would be better off with a woman counsellor. Sometimes they'd be better off with a sexual therapist and go through therapy. Sometimes simply because I think that there's something going on in our personalities that's not good. And I think just be aware of that, and don't feel a failure if you refer, okay? In fact, if you refer, you've probably just hit one of your first big successes, you know what I mean? Because you've known yourself well enough and honestly enough to recognise where your limitation is. But if you do ascertain that this is an issue we can help in, then give that help and do it in the way that you best know how. They'd be the sorts of things that I want to leave with you today. And of course, as a Christian counsellor, I don't use prayer as a stage. I just pray like crazy every stage. And I think that you need to be doing that, because the wisdom that the Christian counsellor has got that the non-Christian counsellor hasn't got is God's wisdom. But we have to ask God for it, right? He says, ask for it, nothing wavering. And he'll give it to you, and it'll surprise the socks off you sometimes. You'll find yourself saying things that you wonder where they came from. And God gave it to you when he needs to, yes.
What do you do with a person that you recognise needs to be referred to somebody else, but who refuses to go?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I think you've got a couple of options. One option is that you could offer to go with them. And the way I would do that is I would ring up the person I was referring them to while they're in the office, while the person's in the office, and I would say, look, I've just been talking to a counsellor I have with me here, or a person I have with me here, and it's my feeling that you would be a great help to her, and I would like to send her to you. But right now she has a real difficulty about that, and feels that maybe I'm duck shoving, or feels very insecure, and I was wondering how you would feel if I brought her to see you tomorrow morning or next week or whatever. And most counsellors, and this has happened to me a number of times, people have done this with me, I've said, by all means come, but I'll say to them, there may be a point in the counselling process where I ask you to leave, but come anyway. And then somewhere in the counselling session I'll say to the lady, how are you feeling now? Oh, I feel okay. Well, I'm going to suggest that Mrs. So-and-so waits outside now so that we can go on with the session. And if you want to share with her afterwards what happened, that's fine. And then I'll do that. If she insists that she stays, well, okay, she stays. But generally that's what I would do. But so that's one thing. The other thing would be to say, okay then, let's move the referral down the track a couple of weeks. Let's spend another couple of weeks together exploring some of the things so I can demonstrate to you how referral would help you. And then I would spend the next couple of weeks saying, now you can understand that if we were able to move into therapy here, then this would be a tremendous help to you, but that's not my area. I can't do that. That's why I want to send you to someone else. The biggest two biggest reasons why people won't go, I think there's three. I'll say two first. There's two reasons why people won't go to therapists, won't accept referral. One is that they feel insecure. It took them a lot to come to you in the first place, and they don't want to go and tell the same story to someone again. They want to short-circuit that. In most cases, they will have to tell the same story again because the therapist is going to want to hear that himself or herself and explore that himself or herself. And so they don't want to go through it all again. It's been too painful. And the second reason will be is that they may be developing a dependence on you and they don't want to leave you because you're part of their their survival now. And without you, they're not sure they're going to survive. And sometimes that's our fault because we've let them build that dependence. Sometimes it's not our fault. We've tried hard not to, but they've built it anyway. And that's a difficult one.
And they could be using that relationship to meet their all their needs rather than back where it should be.
Right. Which is exactly what I was going to say for the third one. I was hesitating splitting those two, but I decided it's probably worth speaking. The third thing is that they might be into transference. And that is that they have now got you meeting a father need or a mother need or a husband need or a wife need in their emotional lives. And perhaps I should spend a couple of minutes talking about that because it's terribly important. If you get involved in counselling, a person, even one session, don't kid yourself, it has to be long term, always remember that there's the possibility that transference will take place. Now, that's not because the person you're counselling is a bad person or because they're a husband snatcher or a wife snatcher or anything like that, but part of the emotional response, part of the emotional process that's going on for them is the desperate need to fill a vacuum in their lives. And this, let's create a scenario, the most common scenario. This lady comes and she talks to this male counsellor. She has a husband who she's been married to for 20 years. She's tried 100 times to tell him these things and he's never understood her. She's been to the minister a couple of times. He doesn't understand. And then suddenly there's a man sitting there opposite her, eyes wide open, eyeballing it with her, nodding his head, receiving what she's saying, empathising with her pain. And she sees the father she's always wanted. She sees her husband she's always wanted. And quite automatically, she begins to transfer onto you that need. And there's only a small step from that to seeing you actually in that role. And she begins to say things like, you know, nobody has ever understood me like you understand me. And nobody has ever listened to me like you've listened. You are the first person, I've lost count of how often I've heard this, you are the first person who's ever listened to me like that.
Or understood how I feel.
Now, I've reached a stage where when a person says that, a little red light goes flick, 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 flick. I think, uh-oh, this person's not doing anything wrong, but I have to be careful here. You see, I have to be careful for their sake. Given up being careful for my sake, I have to be careful for their sake because it's their life that I'm dealing with here. That might be a good reason for referral, but on the other hand, I need, if I'm trained in transference, I may be able to pick that up very gently and be able to float it back to them and say, do you see what you're doing? You have such a deep need to be loved that you're even beginning to see that I might meet that need. Now, you need to be trained how to do that. So don't start practicing that too quick till you've worked on it. But a trained counsellor is taught how to do that and very gently and very beautifully help the person through that stage. The person says, gee, you know, I've done that all my life. I can see now, I did that when I was at high school. I fell in love with all these 25-year-old school teachers. You know, I was really looking for a father. And she begins to get a picture of herself that she's never got before, and she falls out of love with you, and hopefully you're not disappointed, and she gets on with her life. But the trap is this. The counselor's sitting there, and the girl's giving him everything, and he looks at her and he says, you know, what a lovely girl. And look how she trusts me, just like the daughter I've always wanted. Or she begins to tell him what a wonderful counsellor he is, and he thinks, gee, my wife's never told me that. I've looked for approval like that all my married life. And I just ache for my wife to tell me how understanding I am, and how loving I am, and how gentle I am, and she's never told me that. And here's the wife I've always wanted. And before long, he's into counter-transference. That's what happens. And then the news gets out. that great counsellor in Sydney has gone shot through with his counselling. Now, why did he do it? Not because he's a bad man. The counsellors and the ministers who go through with counsellees and secretaries and others, they're not bad people. Often they're the very people you would have least expected it. Sometimes they're the most godly people. But it's happened. Why has it happened? It's happened because a dynamic has gone on that they haven't understood. They haven't dealt with it quickly enough. And before long, because they don't understand what falling in love with is, they don't understand it as a psychosexual dynamic, they're in up to their neck. And then, of course, most of those sorts of guys have a strong sense of honour. And now they, for some reason or other, feel more sense of honour toward this new person than they do their wife. And kaboom, it's all done and finished and gone through. And it's tragic for them, it's tragic for the church, it's tragic for all the Christians in knowing them. And it happens. I mean, I was a young counsellor when, and I loved a man who, and trusted a man, the only man I knew in Australia, who talked about these things and talked about counselling. And I used to ring him up from one capital city to another to talk to about my counselling problems. And then one day, shot through with a counselling. And I went into a tailspin. I didn't know whether to condemn him or I didn't know what to do. But I'm older now and I've sat with dozens and dozens of couples who've been that way. I understand it. I don't condemn people, but I want to warn you, it can happen. And I don't care how godly you are, it can happen. And you have to be very careful of that.
Well, you have to get on with your attitude to that guy.
I had difficulty with that for a long time. You know what it did to me? It made me afraid. I think I was more aware of fear of what was going to happen to us, and then I was afraid, angry, I think. But I want to say, if you're in counselling, you know what you must do. I'm not usually dogmatic, all right? But I'm going to be real dogmatic. If you're into counselling, that is, you counsel more than two people a year. I'm going to be real dogmatic. You should have a supervisor. Now, there's some folks here who are into counselling, and in an official sense, and they know they're not allowed to operate without a supervisor. Isn't that right? If you're in the marriage counselling, Anglican marriage counselling, or Baptist marriage counselling, or Victorian or New South Wales marriage counselling, you are not allowed to operate without a supervisor. Now, a supervisor in that sense is someone that you go to on a regular basis, often a weekly basis, and you talk to about your cases, and they talk to you about what they identify as going on, and it's a professional development, and it's a self-protection. And it's very, very important. Now, the supervisor in the sense that I'm talking about is someone that you ask to contract with you to be your spiritual director or supervisor or whatever you want to call them, that you will go to on a regular basis, and they'll do three things. One is they are your confidant, and you can confide in them anything you want. And it's lovely to be a counsellor who's got a counsellor. But they're not really your counsellor, they're just your confidant, someone that you can share your fears with. Once they get counselling you, they're no longer your supervisor. They're your confidant. Secondly, they're the person who can identify when you're getting hooked into something. Now, you don't only get hooked in transference, you can get hooked in other things. I have talked to my supervisor. The supervisor says, Graham, how come you're so angry at that person? I'm not angry at them. Yes, you are. You are really angry at that person. And I've had to think about it and say, yeah, I am. And I'm angry because I think they're manipulating me. And the person has said, well, you know, it's your problem, not theirs. And my supervisor has been able to help me with that and help me work through that. And the third thing is that skills development, and professional development, skills development, that your supervisor will be able to say, look, you seem to be a bit weak in this area. You haven't read much in this area. I want you to go away and buy this book. I want you to read it. Next time you come back, I want you to talk to me about it. And that's an important part of supervision. Now, where do you find people like that? I think you can find them in three places. One is, it may be a clergyman from another denomination or another church who has perhaps done something like CPE, Clinical Pastoral Education, or something similar, who understands the importance of supervision. You may have to travel for it. You may have to go from Lithgow to Sydney. But you may know somebody who is suitable to do that. The second thing is that you may be working with a number of people who are doing counselling, and you may be able to provide for each other some peer group supervision. That's not as good, but it's better than nothing, right? If it's good, honest peer group. It's not as good, it's not a substitute for supervision, but I am human enough and practical enough to realise that you can't always find a supervisor. The third thing is you might pay a professional counsellor to give you that supervision. Now, if you're doing two people a year, you may only have to go while you're involved in those. So if you're counselling a person for 6 months or 4 months or 3 months, you should go to your supervisor, say, once a month during that time. And it might be someone you have to pay $20, $30, $40, $50 a session to do it, but it's a good investment. And it may well be that you get your church, if you're recognised as a counsellor in the church, you get your church to write into their budget supervisory costs. Now at Elkanah we're supervising people. I set up a program in Geelong last year where there's a whole number of ministers now getting supervision, and most of them are paying for it, and their church pays for it for them. Supervisory costs. And I won't hurt any assembly represented here to pay supervisory costs for the people in their church who they expect to counsel. By the way, it wouldn't hurt any assembly represented here to pick out the counselling people and send them to a good course and pay for it. Now, if people come to me and say, how can we as a couple come to Elkanah and do the counselling course? It's going to cost us $1,300 or $1,400 or something. That's absolutely ridiculous. How can we do that? And my answer is, if your church values you, they'll send you. And they'll pay for it, and that'll be cheap at half the price to do that. And I want to challenge you up here in Sydney, if you're really dead in earnest about caring for people, pick out your skilled people and get them trained, and then get them supervised. That's the important thing.
I was thinking of perhaps somebody who doesn't see themselves as a counsellor, a professional counsellor as such, but is very much into the people helping. You know, some people just have the personality where people flock to them and share, and they feel that they can help so far. Now, I think we need to be very careful, as you say, who we choose to go and get some help from in counselling.
Yes, yes.
Because if we're not careful, we can use it as an information thing to pass on, passing on information that we shouldn't. It
becomes an ego thing.
Yeah, it becomes an ego thing. Therefore, we really need to pick somebody whom we respect and sees they know more than we do in that field.
Oh, yes.
And that keep someone who's going to keep confidentiality.
Don't pick a nice lady in your church to be your supervisor. Or a nice man. Pick someone who's got understanding of supervision. And if they haven't, but they've got the skills, then wouldn't it be great in Sydney if a number of people were sent somewhere to get training in how to supervise counsellors? Wouldn't it be a great move, Graham, if some of the marriage celebrants and marriage counsellors in Sydney were actually chosen out and given training in supervising, so that they would be known as the sorts of people to plug into? And that sort of training may be gained through some branch of the CPE, may be gained through something that goes on here in Sydney, may be gained at Elkanah, but whatever it is, I reckon that would be a fantastic thing to keep in mind. We are 12 minutes late for lunch, which is right because we were 12 minutes late for morning tea. So let's stop, let's go and have lunch, and we're going to put a little bit of pressure on you, but it's for your good, to say we're going to try to get back here by about quarter to two, so it'll be a quick lunch. Okay.